Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Wayne Herring, owner along with his wife Catherine and fellow family member Michael of Herring's Greengrass Farm. Wayne has spent the last several years growing his pasture-based meat operation while also being a steward of the land. This has not always been an easy path, as you'll hear, because like some other farmers, he works off the farm during the week and returns to home each night to continue tending his animals. Wayne also happens to be my wife's cousin, so I got to speak with him at length about his farm and sample some of his chicken at a family event. Ever since then, I've wanted to interview him because he's doing the work of starting a stewardship farm from the ground up and in the best ways he can. In our conversation, we cover the early days of starting the farm and what his inspiration was that brings us to this moment and what it's like to continue the transition to farm full time. Along the way, we also talk about the truth of profit and loss in farming and the role of community in getting started and continuing to grow. If you enjoy this interview or any other episode of the show, please consider making a donation. You can do so by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Wayne Herring. I'll join you again afterwards with more thoughts. Then Wayne, if you can give us a bit about your background and how you came to farming, we can take it from there.
My background and how we got to farming, my wife and I, have been feeding our children, or we've been trying to feed our children, organic food. And that included mostly the conventional organic, if you will, things that you would have bought at the grocery store, things that we could find at the local grocery store, which in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania is difficult. But you can find some things. And my wife is a big user of Amazon, and so she would order perhaps organic peanut butter and things like that in bulk online. So it started with trying to feed our children in the right way. And at some point we had gone and purchased some organic chicken. We were looking for organic chicken on the internet, and we found a farmer in Lancaster County who was advertising pasture raised organic chicken. And I called the farmer, and it was a long drive down to Lancaster, so I found some other local people who would be willing to bulk purchase with me, which did two things. One, they helped me pay for my fuel to go down there, and two, we got a better price because we bought the chickens in bulk. And so for the first time, I went to a farm locally, and fairly locally at least, and bought chickens in bulk, and we bought them direct from the farmer, and he put them on a scale and put them in a cooler, and we brought them home, and I had people come over to the house and we distributed them. There wasn't a lot. We may have gotten, 30 or 35, something like that the first time. And then I purchased from that farmer again that year. And at that time I had bought some beef and really spent some time with him. His name is Nate Thomas. He has a farm called Breakaway Farm in Lancaster. I spent some time talking to him about what he was doing and talking to him about, in fact, what he had done is he had actually left a job in corporate America working as an engineer to go back to the farm. His family were farmers, and he went back and started working with his father to do this pasture-based meat farm. It was interesting. It was intriguing, but I didn't think a whole lot about it, except that the chicken was good and we liked it. And then the following year we bought chicken. We found a local Mennonite family, and they had pasture-raised chickens. And at that point, I actually got to see the chickens out in pasture in a pen, and we bought some chickens, same thing, from them in bulk, and went in with some other people, and that was all well and good. And I believe that year, I also bought a whole pig from Breakaway Farm from Nate Thomas down in Lancaster. And my family is, I come from a long line of farmers, as you know, but I've been away from, and we've been two generations from the farm. I guess my parents' generation didn't farm, and neither has mine until now. I still understand how to take an animal from the hoof and prepare it for the dinner table, so to speak. So again, because we didn't have a lot of income at that moment, we went and I purchased a whole pig and butchered him myself and put it in the freezer myself. So that was year two. And I suppose in year three, my wife and I were having our annual family planning session, goal setting. And I don't know if it's annual because I'm not sure we've done it since then, but I can remember sitting in a diner at Christmas and talking about things we wanted to accomplish for the year. And we were talking about feeding our children because we were quite conscious of that and talked about it a lot. And at that time, I said, you know, I think we could raise some of our own chicken because when I was a kid, I raised ringneck pheasants. My grandparents, who I grew up with, were tenants at a sportsman's club, and we used to get day-old chick pheasants, and we would raise them. And at the time, like a lot of kids, I didn't like to do my chores, and I hated those pheasants. And I sometimes can't believe that now we're raising chickens and other animals, considering my tendency to complain about doing chores when I was a kid. But at any rate, I thought we could do it, and so we went to Tractor Supply, and we bought 10 chickens, 10 baby chick meat chickens, broiler chickens, and we brought them home, and we just bought a bag of feed at the Agway store, and we started in our garage, and at that point, I started researching online for ways to grow these chickens outside and plans to build a pen, and I guess I found a set of plans for Mother Earth magazine. So we built our first pen and put chickens outside, and somewhere right in that area, I had a friend who gave me a copy of Joel Salatin's book, which was called Pastured Poultry Prophets. I read the book, and I realized all of a sudden that apparently there were people farming and going back to farming who were my age or younger and actually doing it for a living. And at that point, I read the book, and I was interested, and we liked growing the chickens, and then 10 became 30, and 30 became 50, and by the end of that year, we had raised 125 chickens in our garage, but then also I have a family member who had 100 acres of land and electrical power where we could plug a brooder light in, and we raised the chickens over there, and the other thing that happened that summer is we went on a vacation to Virginia and we visited Polyface Farm. My wife and our kids walked around the farm and I got to see Joel Salatin drive by in his four-wheeler and he waved at us and that was exciting. And again, I saw that somebody was doing this and somebody was, by that time I had read a lot of Joel's writings about pasture-based farming and healing the land and not killing and not using Roundup and things like that. But I really got to see it and I got to conceptualize that this could be done. In fact, one chicken pen at a time, one customer at a time. And anyway, so I guess, I don't know how far to take it, but that's a little bit about my background, a little bit how we started. And, I probably could go on and on about the whole story and where we're at now, but you don't want to hear that maybe right at the moment.
Well, that is part of the process, is hearing that story. And I like to allow guests the opportunity to develop their answers however they wish. But to direct this a little bit more, you say that that was year three when you got around to really raising and using both at your own home and at a family member's property. Where are you now in that timeline? If that was year three, what year are you in now with farming?
Six.
In those 3 years since then, what all are you raising now? I know that when we had a conversation previously, we were talking about pig, and you still had the chickens. You were also raising turkey at the time?
Yeah, last year would have been the third year actually farming, or year five on that little path. And last year we had chickens and turkeys and pigs. And I think that was the second year that we had chickens, turkeys, and pigs. And now where we're at, we have some egg-laying chickens as well.
So you went from raising in your garage with a little bit of outdoor to a family's property.
In a garage in a subdivision where you're not supposed to have any kind of livestock or animals, yeah.
You were actually in the suburbs doing that?
Well, as much as there's suburbs in Pottsville, the area of Pottsville, Pennsylvania, a little subdivision, right? Half-acre lots where people mow their grass and wash their cars and don't have a clothesline, that sort of thing.
Nobody heard the noise of the chickens and came over to investigate?
Well, neighbor kids are pretty attracted to day-old chicks or little chicks, so we had some neighbors who came over and took a look at it, and I know my wife was told at the bus stop that, we're not allowed to have chickens here in the neighborhood, and I think she sort of brushed that off and said, I did read that, but we have them.
Going through Harrisburg, I know that there are some folks who are definitely raising chickens against ordinance. depending on where you drive through, sometimes you can hear them. You're like, chickens in the city, that's interesting.
You know, if we hadn't moved out of the subdivision, I'm pretty sure we'd be fighting the good fight at the moment. But we moved out of the subdivision, so.
From that experience, how many acres are you there? I shouldn't say how many acres you have now, but how many acres are you using now to raise these three different, well, I guess really four different animals if you differentiate the chickens between meat chickens and the egg laying. What kind of space do you use?
Sure. So when we had moved over, it was my father's property where the animals had been. And over there, I would have guessed that we were using actual pasture that we were using would have been maybe 7 acres last year. And on those 7 acres, we raised 1,200 broiler chickens, about 50 turkeys, and 20 pigs. Perhaps we could have been a little bit more, not confined, because it's not what we want to be, but we could have had the animals using a smaller area. But quite frankly, there's so much, not so much, but there's 100 acres at my dad's place there, and it was pretty easy to keep things spread apart and separate. But where we're at now, the path was we decided we were going to sell our house in the subdivision. And because of, we had 0.4 acres and what we're going to do. And the other thing is I was driving myself crazy, commuting to the farm in the morning and commuting back. And then every time you'd have a thunderstorm, you'd be worried that maybe the brooder light was out and you would have a bunch of little chicks who were dying because they were smothering each other. Or you were worried that there was a rain getting into the shelter or whatever the case may be. And whenever we had the hurricane last year, you know, you batten down the hatches as best you can 24 hours ahead of time and then go check later on. It's just not very fun. So we sold the house in the subdivision, which wasn't easy in this market, but we sold it and we lived in a temporary rental house while we built a house on this new place. And we now have 20 acres. And on the 20 acres, we really just got started for the year. So we're using maybe an acre right at this moment. But our plan is to use the whole thing. I did a lot of work this weekend. We have a water line laid out from the house. And we have 5 pastured boiler shelters out in the field. And we've got 225 3-week-old broilers right now. And they'll go out to the field this afternoon, maybe even after I'm off the phone with you here. And then we'll have another batch of day-old chicks come next week. And then we've got 20 laying hens, and we're building an egg mobile that'll hold about 200 laying hens. So yeah, there's a lot going on. It's been crazy moving here.
That's quite a transition to go through, to be having the 7 acres and raising all that to then moving to your own property with your own house and continuing that transition. What has this process been like to transition to farming for you and your family? Has it been a pretty natural progression because of the way that you've been moving, or have you found it to be kind of stressful at times?
Oh, gosh. I Facebooked a farmer friend of mine this morning, and I said, is it normal to sometimes go to bed at night and be thinking you're going to quit doing all this and then wake up the next morning and hear the chickens and be completely ready to go do it again? Am I crazy, or does that happen to other people? And the answer was that he had lost a sow pig yesterday, and that, yeah, it doesn't happen a lot, but it still happens to him, and it certainly happened a lot in the beginning. So, yeah, it's really stressful to move, and at this time of the year, we just moved, and this time of the year, with what we're doing right now, is stressful in that you're setting up all your systems for the rest of the summer to run on, including, because we do direct marketing, you're setting up emails to customers, you're setting up the web store for ordering, things like that.
You mentioned direct marketing to your customers. Are you involved in any kind of like a CSA or a farm share with your customers, or is it just direct sales as product?
Right. We don't do CSA. However, we're a member of a vegetable CSA. And, you know, that's another thing I probably left out in our path. You know, we have friends who are nearby who we've been members of their vegetable CSA for 3 or 4 years, and they're called Little Peace Farm, and we're members of that CSA, but no, we do not do any CSA with the meat. And I think part of that has been because I have a full-time job and it's pretty intense, And because of the commuting that I was doing from the farm back to our house last year, it's been difficult to feel like we would be properly using people's money at this point if we did a CSA, where, of course, they invest in the farm up front. And there was too much uncertainty for me to feel comfortable doing that. That may come down the road. I have some friends who do a meat CSA, but I'm not quite ready for that at the moment. So everything is, you raise it, and when I'm about 2 weeks out from harvest date for chickens, I'll post everything online, and then people will place their orders.
As a small farm, you say that you'll be getting day-old chicks in. Is that a fairly normal process to be ordering chicks from a supplier elsewhere, or will you transition to like having your own flock to produce future generations from?
Yeah, well, you know, who knows what the future holds, Scott, but I know, you know, you're interested in permaculture and sustainability, and the reality is that what we do with day-old broiler chicks is one of those things that the day-old broiler chicks are coming from a big supplier of chicks, and they've got the laying flock and the breeding flock. And so we get these day-old chicks, and when these day-old chicks hit here, there's no other broiler chick in America, unless they're on a farm like ours, that is going to experience the life that they're going to have, because they are in uncrowded conditions. When they're in the brooder huts, they're getting frequent additional layers of deep bedding, wood chips. And then, of course, they're going out in the field, and they are in broiler shelters, which is a 10-foot by 12-foot open bottom pen that gives them protection from predators. But we move that at least daily, sometimes twice daily, depending on how big they are and how much manure they're dropping and what the temperatures are like. And so, you know, they really get to be out and about, and they get to eat grass and bugs and do their thing. But the reality is that the chickens are coming from, the day-old chicks are sort of coming from the machine, you know, the big ag infrastructure in the United States. So I don't like that necessarily, and yet, even with what we do, with as labor intensive as it is, and with feeding them organic grain, which is not certified organic grain, because that would add a whole nother level of expense, I'm still selling chicken for $3.95 a pound. And people are paying Purdue in the store, what, $1 a pound? I don't even know. I don't buy it. But cheap, right? Really cheap. So it's one of those things where I would love someday, and I've even thought about, we're getting barred rock chicks. And I have a friend who is, we're going to buy some of those chicks from, and he takes the eggs and incubates them. And, you know, in the old days, certainly they would have incubated their own, or the chickens would have incubated their eggs, and the females would have become next year's laying flock, and the males would have become friars. But in today's world, where there's an appetite for chicken, it would be, it's difficult, and there's some challenges there.
There's that line between theory and practice and reality. When you still need dollars and cents to run a business, that you can't necessarily do everything that would meet your personal ethical or moral views, and I understand that there needs to be those kinds of compromises. I was wondering where that plan would go, but hearing from you and thinking about it, well, if when your hens are laying, whether or not those eggs get fertilized, having to figure that out and then get those eggs to hatch and everything else, I can understand how the inconsistency of raising your own, unless you had a flock of a certain size, how that could be an issue, and that buying in chicks directly provides you that stability to run a business that's profitable enough to do these other sustainable practices that you're already involved in.
Right.
And I would never fault anyone for making those kinds of choices.
Yeah, I'm certainly not being defensive about that at all. It's just one of those things. When you're doing what we're doing, you spend a lot of time reading and you spend a lot of time thinking. And, you know, here we've got 20 acres of land. And I think, you know, wow, you know, we're really blessed to have this land. And it's our job to care for it and take care of it. I work, my day job here is I work from home today. And at lunchtime, I took, 30, 40 minutes. And the kids and I were, we have a creek that went through there. And I put my sandals on, I went down there and we went walking through the creek, you know. And when you look at your kid and you look at this land that you're on and you think, boy, this is a big gift. It's great to have. It's also a big responsibility. So you start thinking about some of those, if you care, you know, if you care. And there is a balance, because reality is, like I said, people, you know, want to buy, quote, organic chicken. And I know what we're doing blows away what comes out of, you know, a, quote, organic confinement chicken house. And it's going to provide cash flow and income to be able to do some other things, like hopefully pastured beef, which I know intensive grazing. Now, there's a system where I can have cows that drop calves on the land and then eat the grass that grows here. And that is the kind of the end of it all, and the best of the best. But yeah, chickens along the way are a means to get there. And the grain that we're buying to feed them is being grown by a small local family who has a mill. So it's the whole sustainability thing and where we're going is, it's not quite as black and white as I would like for it to be.
And that's where that long view approach, as you say, as you're walking through the stream and you think about, as you care about that, and you think about the intergenerational effect that that can have by having your family there, feeding them the way that you do, that as you make the sacrifices and put these systems in place and grow them, that in a generation or two, you'll have everything in place so that the decisions that you are making now aren't ones that need to be made by your children or grandchildren, because you'll have everything in place where they can just go and do this work and not have to worry about how they're compromising the values that you've instilled in them.
Hopefully.
We cross our fingers as we do these things and realize that we can only do so much as parents. But as you raise the chickens now, and you've talked about, you know, the cash flow and business side of it, do you mind my asking, has farming for you over the past several years been a profitable venture?
I shouldn't laugh, right? No, not until this point. We certainly have not made money, because last year we would have broken even if we hadn't bought any equipment. So last year we bought a chicken scalder, and everybody's favorite piece of equipment, a chicken plucker. If you ever want to watch something funny, plug into YouTube and look up chicken plucker, and you'll find some twisted entertainment, perhaps. But last year we invested in this chicken plucker, the scalder. And then the other thing that you end up, you know, buying a lot of is water line to get water to the pigs, and water nipples and little shelters and a lot of things that you wouldn't have even thought of. But as you think through the life cycle of an animal on your farm, you have to, there's quite a few different stages. Last year we bought a 10-foot by 20-foot shelter beneath which we could do the processing. And so last year we would have broke even if it weren't for the equipment, but that's not considering any labor on my part or any return either. So now the other thing I do, though, is I do a lot of spreadsheeting and calculation of costs, and I break down my costs by the broiler chickens, turkeys, pigs. And now I was going through an exercise with my children, showing them how do we arrive at what a reasonable and fair price is for a dozen of eggs, where you also manage to get paid something for taking care of the chickens and putting the eggs out.
So you're teaching your children some of the cost accounting involved with running the business.
Oh, gosh, having a little farm like this is an amazing way to teach kids so many different things. And that's one of the really positive things that has lured us into doing this. You know, even if we weren't doing this with a mind to healing the earth to a degree, or while we're here and setting up systems to do it more, and even if we weren't thinking about feeding our kids organic food, just the business side of it, into, you know, because we all live in today's world where you have to, there's some realities to the economic system that we're in. And it teaches them lessons on, you know, math right there, and understanding profit and loss, and, you know, why is this math they're doing with their homeschool with their mother important? And they've gone to the farmer's market and sold some necklaces and things like that they've made. And so, you know, they get to meet people, or they get to meet diverse people who, you know, you have a diverse crowd who is attracted and who's to products like this and who's part of our customer list. Yeah, that's great for the kid.
Now, you said you were working from home today and that you have a full-time job. moving into what you're doing now, do you come from an entrepreneurial background where you had a lot of like business knowledge and business sense going into this? Or is that something else that you've learned along the way?
I would say I brought that here. My father has a pretty successful business doing nothing related to agriculture, and I've been part of that for the past 9 years, and so I do sales and marketing on a day-to-day basis and manage a sales force. So I understand profit and loss statements, and I get involved with budgeting and things of that nature. And then before I came back to this business, I did project management, sales, project management, and engineering in the construction industry. So yes, I'm fortunate and I have some transferable skills from those other life pursuits.
Coming into this from that background as an entrepreneur, you say that you had some skills that transferred over. What have been some of the hardest skills for you to develop as you transition more and more into farming? What have been some of your difficulties?
I know a whole lot more about sales, marketing, and business, although you might not believe that when I tell you I haven't made a profit yet, but I think I know. I know enough to be dangerous. I know more about sales, marketing, and business things than I do about farming. So probably my biggest challenge has been learning how to farm. And as I said, I'm two generations removed from the farm. So other than my experience raising pheasants when I was a kid, I've not raised pigs. You know, what do you do when you have a sick pig? What do you do when the pigs are out of the fence? Those kind of things have probably been more challenging. Well, I didn't consider myself, although you kind of get forced into it when you're doing farming. I never considered myself to be very handy. I would call a repairman if there was something wrong with the plumbing in our house kind of thing. But I learned to do a lot of those things. And sometimes I've learned by banging my knuckles. But the other thing is I'm, you know, really fortunate to be surrounded with my dad and grandfather still have some, in my grandfather's case, you know, quite a bit of knowledge of farming. And then, yeah, my dad too. He worked on a farm when he was a kid with dairy cows. And but the other big thing is for anybody, I know you said in the beginning, a lot of this has to do with people who might be interested in doing this sort of thing. If you ask for help, if you approach people, there are so many people out there that are glad to help starting farmers. There's, you know, I'm a member of something called APA, which is the American Pastured Poultry Association. And there's an email thread that I get that's for all people doing pastured poultry like we're doing. You can connect through farmers there. There's a group called PASA, which you probably are aware of, Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Ag. And they have their conference and they've got message boards. And then the other thing I think is, if you just approach people who are doing farming and say, you know, I'm interested in this, and it's good if you have some sort of, that you've learned a little bit and done your homework in terms of doing as much reading and self-study as you can. But if you approach these people, they've been very, very gracious of their time and their skills and their knowledge. I mentioned this morning, I Facebooked with somebody else who I know who's a farmer, and I've spent time on another farmer's place. You know, and I donated my time to process chickens with him, but in return, and it's not like he and I talked about, hey, how about I process chickens and then you can show me something. I mean, you just do it. You just do things together in community. And I've gotten a lot of help from him, this guy John Hopkins from in Bloomsbury.
As you continue to develop as a farmer and work and interact with people, are you finding a larger and larger community both between the other farmers and your customers that becomes kind of a mutual support network?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, definitely. Our customers are great, and they provide, I mean, how can you get better advertising than when your customers go out and tell other people, boy, you really need to go meet Wayne, and you get an email with their copied on it and say, I was introduced to you by, you know, Nancy or whoever. Yeah, both to your customers and the other farmers are absolutely a very strong and vital, necessary community to do this. You know, when you have a day where, you know, you're at your new place and you're trying to get water lines out and you feel like you haven't spent enough time with the kids, and next thing you know, you realize that there's a piece missing. So it's that sort of thing that helps keep you driving, helps keeps you moving forward, even if they're not there with you right at that moment.
As you're out there working and you're building your farm and you're taking time with your family and you're building your community and you're working your day job, as you continue down this road, as you make this move, do you see these pieces coming together and getting a little bit easier now that you're in year six, even though you're developing the new place? You've made some of those connections. You've spent that time with your family to know how all those pieces fit together, or if they don't, they're starting to kind of like line up in a row and you can enjoy what you're doing a little bit more and take more from it?
Honestly, this year will be a big test to see where we go, how we do it, what happens, because the huge thing that's different this year than last year is I no longer have that 15-minute drive to the farm in the morning and then 15 minutes to work, so on and so forth, and then the fears of not being there when things are going on. So now I don't have a drive. I walk off my front porch. The other thing that I have here that's great is my wife, Catherine, helps out tremendously, and I still travel some for the, quote, day job, which is a good job and pays the bills. And when I'm gone, she's been taking care of the animals along with my oldest daughter, who is now almost 10 years old. She's been taking care of the land hen. So this year is critical in that it's a big change to have everything right here and to have them be available to help and not have to do the drive. And just to give, you know, an idea of how crazy things were last year, when we would have our days, which were normally Saturdays, when we were going to process chickens and prepare them for sale, which is a nice way of saying kill them and take their feathers off and put them in a plastic bag, right? The day would normally start for me at 4:30, and that was so I could get up in time, get over to the farm, and at the crack of dawn, we'd have chickens caught and in coops. We'd have them ready to process. We'd process them through, and then I'd be putting them in coolers with ice and water and chill. And you have to do that. Normally I kind of change the chickens over in the chilling process to two different containers, and we'd get them all loaded up in a trailer and drive home. And we knew people were coming to our house at 5 o'clock who had pre-ordered to the internet site. And by the time they got here to our house, you know, my wife and I would be frantically trying to weigh them, bag them, get them priced out, so we knew how much to charge people. And then people would be there, and sometimes I, you know, it was so hectic when they would come. I wanted to spend time with them, and people like to talk to their farmer. They like to meet you. And it was a little bit, oh, I didn't mention that part about the subdivision. We've had people pick up their chickens in the subdivision, so I had to sort of bribe all the neighbors with chicken to make sure that they wouldn't complain, anybody elected the zoning department, right? And so it was so frantic and crazy. And this year, here we are, and the chickens will be processed out back. People will come to the farm to pick them up instead of coming to a subdivision where they say, hey, I thought you guys had a farm. And this will be a critical year to see how that all comes together. And then the other thing, you know, like with the job, I'm going to try to work from home a little bit, not so that I can be farming during the day, but rather so that I save some time on either end with my work commute, so I have a little bit more time to devote to family and the farm, and balance, which is what a whole lot of us are all trying to achieve, and me too.
And I can think about working from home 2 days a week and what those 2 hours could gain you for the quality of life with your family, and just the stress of not having to worry about the farm is quite as much. As we've been here for a little bit, and I know that you should probably go and check on your chickens and move a shelter. Thank you so much for your time, Wayne. Is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation before we bring this interview to a close?
Boy, I feel like I've done a lot of talking, so I don't think, well, I guess the only thing I'll say is I'm grateful for anybody in the media who is taking the time to explore stories like this and tell other people about things that are happening and give them resources and places to go where they can find, let's say, inspiration, support, and answers to their questions. So thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you for your time and coming on to talk with me and share your story. I'm sure that it will be helpful for many people.
Okay. Well, have a great day.
And that was Wayne Herring. As with all of my guests, I'm thankful for his candor in this conversation, his willingness to share the ups and downs of what he's doing, and what the life of a new farmer is like. Community support, as mentioned in this episode, holds a great deal of meaning to me as I look beyond the visible structures of permaculture to the invisible ones. While putting together this show, I received Wayne's newsletter, and in there he offered support and recommended his customers attend a local farmer's market to help bolster the beginnings of the market. Throughout the independent and small-scale producers, I see this mutual aid occurring, that different farmers help one another grow what they're doing, and the people who believe in their work support them as best they can. As we take care of the earth and ourselves, doing what matters to us and raising ourselves up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and in fulfilling the first two ethics of permaculture, it becomes easier to have a surplus to share, and with it to help share what we have to help others with their needs. And as I'm finding over and over again within these communities, it speaks against the ideas of a handout, and instead that it is a hand up, that we are supporting and assisting each other, teaching one another how to grow food, how to live better lives, rather than just giving food. And as we are able to do so, to share that surplus, it's easier to limit consumption. You can make better choices that aren't drastic or hasty, and in turn care for the earth in a better way. Care for yourself and your family and friends in a better way, and in the process, free up more resources to share with others. Once this ball gets rolling down the hill, it becomes ever more self-sustaining, which is important because it's easy to teach and understand the physical sides of permaculture, but those invisible ones, being intangible, are hard to grasp. But I think that the root of those invisible structures are in the ethics of permaculture. If after listening to this episode you have more questions, or want to comment on anything you heard or some of my thoughts here, please let me know. You can leave a comment in the show notes for this episode, send me a message on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst, or through the Facebook page, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Or, of course, there's always email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. Coming up next week is Nathaniel Mulcahy of World Stove, and we'll be talking about his company and how they are using pyrolytic stoves to create local jobs, reduce atmospheric carbon dioxide, and replenish soils. After that, on June 18th, will be Dr. Wayne Dorband joining me again to discuss the idea of ecolonomics and the work of the Institute for Ecolonomics to help bolster the next generation of ecologically focused entrepreneurs. And for anyone who is interested in the online PDC Plus, registration is now open. That class begins July 1st, and you can join by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/PDC-registration or by following the link in the show notes. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And now the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Feel free to share it with whoever you like, but make sure you tell them where you got it, and don't sell it or change it.